Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations stance point. With your hosts, Bo Spearham and Karina Hogan.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are broadcasting from here today, and also acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which you are taking this broadcast from, no matter whether it be from South Australia, Western Australia, Darwin, all the way down there in Tasmania, up the East Coast in Brizzy, no matter where it might be. I welcome you to Let's Talk this morning. I'd also like to acknowledge elders past, present and emerging, and pay respects to those of more recent arrivals. And again, it's just me today here on Let's Talk. Bo is still taking a well-deserved break. It's Wednesday, hump day. And as I've mentioned throughout the week, this week is Mental Health Week. And we've been confronting those important conversations that can sometimes, you know, get swept aside. Sometimes, you know, we tend to, you know, put them aside and not sort of bring them to light. It can be a difficult thing to bring up, you know, because you find that you have to confront things that, you know, you may seem easier to put away. However, you know, what we've learned from the conversations that we've had this week is that early intervention and speaking about things and getting those issues and bringing them to the forefront, you know, research shows that minimizes the impacts later on in life. You know, yesterday we spoke about perinatal and postnatal depression. We heard from Lee, who spoke about how it affected her for decades. And also with Layla Scott from the Children's Hospital Queensland. If you want to catch that podcast, jump on 98.9fm.com.au and download that podcast. And today we're going to be yarning with an amazing young woman, Raja Clay, who has been on the program before, but she's a Kalkanoon and Bulkholman woman with a solid history working in the mental health space as an advocate and a consumer. She's also had lived experience and currently works in the mental health space. So I'm looking forward to yarning to Raja about what's happening in that space as far as mental health is concerned, where she thinks the important parts are that we need to be advocating for, and, you know, and what her story is. Where's she at with her story? But before we do that, the Palaszczuk government has announced a new climate action plan. And yesterday there was a debate between Leanne Enoch, the Greens, and the LNP party regarding the environment. So today we're going to yarn, or a little bit later, we're going to yarn to Larissa Baldwin, who is a young woman from the Widjibal tribe from the Bundjalung Nation. And she's a co-director for SEED, the Indigenous Youth Climate Network. And she's going to weigh in and tell us what she thinks about what's sort of happening. But before that, you may have seen on social media, Indigenous Peoples Day has been celebrated, that honours Native American people and commemorates their histories and their cultures. It's celebrated across the United States in the second Monday of each October, which was yesterday for them. And it's an official city and state holiday in various locations. But I thought, given that we do Let's Talk History here on 98.9, I wanted to sort of pay attention to that Indigenous Peoples Day, but also Christopher Columbus, because that day, the second Monday of October, has traditionally been a day that's been celebrated by many Americans far and wide, glorifying the arrival or the work of Christopher Columbus. And, you know, I kind of wanted to get to the bottom of it a little bit because, you know, it's not necessarily what it, you know, Christopher Columbus isn't necessarily what you know, he may have been portrayed to be in the past. And I've got Tony Birch, author and historian, on the phone to have a little bit of a yarn about who Christopher Columbus is and you know, what he really represented. Good morning, Tony.
Hiya, how you going?
I'm good. I know that we've had you on here a fair bit, but introduce us, tell us who your mob is.
So my name's Tony Birch. I'm from Melbourne. I'm actually a retired academic, so I until recently worked at Victoria University with people like Gary Foley, Jackie Katona, Kim Kruger, Paola Bella, Karen Jackson, so really good mob from all over Australia. I'm actually myself from Fitzroy, so I grew up in Melbourne in the inner city, and as I've told you before, so we like to call ourselves Fitzroy Blacks. And
solid.
I also involved in Gary Foley and Jackie Katona's School of Discontent, which is an organisation we've set up in Melbourne to combat some of the misinformation and lies that are told about our history and culture, not only in universities but outside them, and sometimes, unfortunately, projected by conservative fellows as well.
Well, that's interesting that we that you talk about talking about the truth about the history of things, because I just wanted to have a quick chat with you about Christopher Columbus. You know, yesterday for America it was Indigenous Peoples Day, which is a holiday that celebrates and honours Native American people and commemorates their histories and cultures. But there was something else that's often celebrated, and that is Christopher Columbus, who was an explorer and navigator who completed four voyages across the Atlantic Ocean. But he was very much glorified in America and throughout a lot of American historical records. Can you tell us what you know about Christopher Columbus?
Well, I mean, Columbus comes out of a period of colonial expansion and violence, which begins in the early 15th century. So you're talking here about European powers such as Britain, Spain, Portugal, and the Dutch, and the French, the Belgians. And over several hundred years, what they're looking for is to conquer Indigenous country, to steal Indigenous country, for issues of mining, to run agriculture, and of course to perform acts of genocide against Indigenous people. So he's part of a whole history of this level of violence, which also includes obviously what happens here in the late 18th century and what becomes Australia. The issue about Columbus that I think might be specific for your listeners, it's really interesting that you've got Larissa Baldwin coming on today talking about the current climate change issue. Mm. One of the things we know about the history of destruction of Indigenous country is the shocking destruction of land in the Americas, so right through North America and South America from the arrival of Columbus, where you see the widespread destruction of Indigenous land, the felling of trees, the destruction of Indigenous plant crops, and of course we know the widespread murder of Indigenous people. So that date, that 1492 date when Columbus arrived, that really does mark the beginning of a shocking period of ecocide and genocide on people. So if Columbus is to be remembered, and he should be remembered, he needs to be remembered as a part of a murderous history. So we don't want to forget him. We need to remember him because we need to remember the history that he's part of, and it's not a history of celebration.
He's very much glorified, and he has been... you know, put on a pedestal very much so. You know, you know, there are various states that are named after him, places in America. There's obviously a day where they celebrate him. There are politicians throughout history that have glorified this man. It's not too indifferent from sort of what's happened here with Captain Cook, is it?
Well, it's no different. And the issue is, of course, is that through the celebration of figures such as Columbus, Cook, and anyone who came afterwards in either continent and other countries and on Indigenous nations, is that what celebration does, and you did say then, by the way, put him on a pedestal, and that's literally so, erecting statues of people. I don't know if Captain Cook's still hovering over Cairns, that 30-foot Captain Cook up there.
I went up there once.
So basically what this does, it's not only to turn the sort of genocide into a celebration of white heroics. It actually masks the reality, so that these are really uncomplicated histories. So, yeah, we would know if you did these histories at school, and we were forced to have to deal with these histories at schools, these histories of heroes fit in very much with a sanitized view of the past. So I think I reckon one of the things that for your listeners to consider is that It's not whether we remember these men, it's how we remember them. So that we don't want to forget, you know, we don't want people to forget these men or the histories that they represent. We just want the histories rewritten, and we want them rewritten
from a black belt perspective. Yeah. Or from a truthful perspective.
Yeah.
Today in Mexico City in particular, protesters in five states have condemned the genocidal explorer from Genoa on the 528th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's arrival in America. Protesters have now taken to the streets this week in several Mexican states to denounce the genocidal explorer. So a statue of Columbus, which is in Mexico City's Reforma Avenue, was removed just on the weekend for restoration, but it came after threats that people were going to topple it. So nevertheless, protesters have still arrived at that place. They're still there. And they've graffitied the fence that has been installed around it. And some of the messages say nothing to celebrate, nothing to forgive, everything to tear down, 528 years of struggle. The fight continues, down with the symbols of colonialism and so on and so forth. So this is still something that is very prevalent. So for those of you listening, I want to play a quick clip about, you know, what Indigenous people of America think about Christopher Columbus. So have a quick listen to this.
What does Christopher Columbus mean to me? A murderer.
Christopher Columbus is a moron.
I think Christopher Columbus is, to put it lightly, a jerk. Christopher Columbus, I think he's disgusting. He brought over colonialism and tried to eradicate indigenous peoples on these lands.
That guy was a sailor lost at sea on these boats that were about to fall apart. I mean, he didn't know where he was, or I mean, his whole conception of the world was completely erroneous, and why we celebrate this man is completely beyond me. But here we are rewriting that history in the way that it should be written.
I am here honoring our ancestors. I hated Columbus Day. Sure, it was a day off from school.
And that there was a bit of a rundown of what Indigenous people in America actually think about Christopher Columbus. And I just received an inbox from my dear friend Glenda Tenner, who has sent me a picture of the statue of Captain Cook that sits up there. Oh, look out. That sits up there in Cairns. It still remains, Tony.
And he's got a sort of, and if you look at it, I'm pretty sure he has a sort of a bit of a quasi-Nazi salute going on there.
He does, so, he does.
Yeah, and he's very skinny. It's the skinniest Captain Cook I've ever seen, but maybe that's because they made him so tall.
Yeah, well, that it was made for a pub, right? So yeah, the organisers behind a petition to remove the Captain Cook statue in hopes the organisers behind a petition to remove the Captain Cook statue in Cairns hopes the council will take notice after they've had 10,000 signatures in just 3 days, and that was back in June. So I believe it's still erected there in Cairns.
Well,
so,
I think it might be good for you to know, though, that Professor Gary Foley has his own idea, and Gary Foley's idea is to leave all the statues up and then send him on a national tour so that he can give a lecture, a revisionist lecture in front of every statue, at least before it's demolished. So I think he could have a great bit of theatre and education.
Oh, that would be brilliant. I'd love to follow him along and do...
Yeah, film it.
Yeah. Well, Tony, thanks.
We can do really innovative and remarkable stuff. I'm sure you've got listeners out there, great young black fellow and black fellows and women who are artists and storytellers. There's a really great opportunity here for us to do really innovative, critical work
absolutely.
On these sort of statues.
Absolutely. And that's what we hope to do here on Let's Talk History as well, is shine a bit of a light on something that you may not know much about. And, you know, while Christopher Columbus has been glorified, along with, some of our good old Captain Cook statues that we have here and the glorification of him, you know, let's continue to learn and continue to open our minds up and to hear the truth. I almost called you Gary then, Tony. But thank you so much for joining us and giving us an insight into what actually...
Thank you very much for having me.
No worries. And that was Tony Birch. He's an author and historian, and he often comes on our program to have a yarn, and we just had a yarn about Christopher Columbus. and what that actual day means to Indigenous people in America. Now, I'm not too sure if you're aware, but we spoke about it last week. Big Sound is coming up. It's not far away. And on that list of 50 for Big Sound 50 are 22 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists. So I'm about to play Mataja, who is one of those featured artists, and I'll tell you a little bit more about her when you return, but then we'll also be catching up with Larissa Baldwin to have a yarn about these new policies that have been announced by the Anastasia Palaszczuk government. So stick with us.
Reminder that the RUIH Home Support Team are still here and we are still checking in with our clients on a weekly basis. You might be feeling disconnected from your community due to isolation, or maybe you're struggling to do daily tasks such as grocery shopping or household chores. Remember, our team are able to support you with the following: one-on-one visits with the Home Support staff member, delivery of fresh cooked meals, keeping you engaged with your clients and appointments, and connecting you with the social health team. If you are a carer and your client is part of the RUIH Home Support Program and you wish to speak with someone in regards to the client or you have general concerns, you can call 1800 802 265 and you'll be connected with one of our friendly staff.
A message from the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health.
Station sponsor.
This is Bo Spearham and Karina Hogan with Let's Talk.
And that was Mataja with Malu Mabuya. And she's one of the 50 artists that have been recognised with Big Sound 2020 this year. It's in its 19th year and produced by Q Music. And, of course, last week we had First Nations director and curator Alethea Beetson on yarning about that deadly lineup that she's got. One of the deadly things about that lineup is that of those 50 artists, that up and coming artists that they've got, 22 of those are blackfellas, and I'm pretty happy with that, because you know we want to be able to see the celebration of our mob in that space really being highlighted. And Mataja, she is a Western Australian singer, songwriter, and producer. And she's an emerging artist creating contemporary Indigenous fusion music. And she uses language quite a lot in her music. So if you want to check her out, her name is spelled M-A-T-A-L-J-A, Mataja. That's just one of many amazing artists. And I'll play another one before we take you out today. But today we've been yarning about, first we kicked the program off yarning about Let's Talk History with Tony Burch, having a yarn about Christopher Columbus and, you know, the real story about Christopher Columbus. And he actually mentioned that Christopher Columbus had a massive impact on what he referred to as eco-genocide, looking at the impact that he had over hundreds of years on America. How it impacted Indigenous people there, which led us to our discussion then around climate action and the environment just in general. And so we're yarning today with the deadly Larissa, who is going to have a yarn to us. Sorry, is Larissa Baldwin, who is a young woman from the Widjibal clan of the Bundjalung Nation. She's a First Nations justice campaign director, at Get Up, and has had a lot to do working in the climate action space. Good morning, Larissa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Can we start by getting you to tell us who your mob is and where you're from?
Yeah, so I grew up on country down in Lismore, and my mob is like old Robert's mob down around Lismore in New South Wales, good family.
Now, the Palaszczuk government here in Queensland has announced a new climate action plan, and there was yesterday a debate between LNP, Labor, and the Greens regarding the environment. But what I want to ask you is, as a young woman, you know, who's very much engrossed in this, what would a climate action or a productive climate action plan look like for you and for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
Yeah, so for me, there's two parts of it. And we can talk about mitigation, which is trying to stop, you know, the types of pollutants and that sort of stuff going into there that's really going to supercharge climate change. And on the other hand, we need to look at adaptation because we've passed the critical decade for climate action. And what we're seeing now, when we're seeing bushfires across the country, when we've seen, you know, in Queensland for many years in a row now, the kind of reef bleaching and that sort of stuff, we're seeing more intense big weather seasons and stuff like that. And so that is the impact of reaching tipping points and surpassing tipping points in terms of our governments not taking the type of action we need.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a part of, like, we need to keep trying to stop the worst of, you know, the predictions that are out there around climate change, because what we're seeing consistently over the last 10 years is that all these predictions that scientists have made are coming true exactly on the timelines that they said that they would if we didn't take action. So we need to start with, obviously, with no new fossil fuels, and that means coal and gas. We need to rapidly transition away from them. We are transitioning away from them, but you've just seen the federal government less than 4 weeks ago announce billions of dollars of subsidies for new gas. We can't be doing that sort of thing, and it really relies on state governments, the Queensland government, to really take some leadership and really transition into a renewable a system that is backed up by the types of energy that will get us in line with climate action.
Sis, let's talk about the transition, because there have been quite a few people, including up in the Torres Straits. There's the Torres Ace. We spoke with Yessie Mosby a couple of weeks ago about them taking a complaint to the United Nations regarding the inaction of the federal government when it comes to climate change and the impacts that's having on their human rights. How do you think the transition is going?
It's not going fast enough. And also in terms of transition, and when we talk about transition and this thing around adaptation, the communities who really need the investment, like the Torres Strait, and yes, he's really wonderful in the work and the advocacy they're doing, but there's a seawall won't protect the Torres Strait. And so there needs to be more investment done on mitigation to stop that sea level rise. People talking about the burial grounds that's being impacted, but really for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and this is why we really need to take leadership on climate, is it's going to mean, if we keep going in the type of projections that we are, it's going to mean forced removal of country for people. People are not going to be able to live on country where it's getting too hot. We're already seeing across the top end of Australia, people are getting sick.
The question is, you know, how do you have a connection with your country if it's underwater?
Exactly. Mm. And so this is a huge loss of, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, like our state, the country. And this is why we talk about protecting country more when we talk about climate change instead of talking about it within a Western frame of science. Because at the end of the day, this really is going to impact our connection to country, which impacts our language, which impacts our culture. And we know that that pays dividends through generations. So it is not just in Australia, but right around the world. Globally, we're seeing Indigenous people really lead and pushing on governments in order to take climate action, because we know the generational impact this will have if we don't do it.
How do you feel about, you know, the states, the various states' reactions to things like Adani and environmental protections in general, when you look at what happened up in Juukan Gorge with Rio Tinto and environmental protections that are currently in place that are clearly not really cutting the mustard? How do you feel about the response of, you know, environmental ministers such as Susan Ley when it comes to situations like protecting cultural heritage and that type of stuff?
I mean, I feel like everyone can see that the mining lobby in this country has a lot of power. And one of the things we need to remind ourselves of is, yes, we've dipped into a recession this year, but for 30 years we've had uninterrupted growth in this country. And mostly that's been built off a mining boom. The other thing that's contributed to that is, and people might not want to talk about it, but it's around the 10-point plan and the attack on native title rights and royalties for First Nations people. 60% of mines in this country are built next to remote Aboriginal communities, and we have not seen the benefits flow through to those communities. It's still living well below the poverty line. Infrastructure is as worse as it's ever been. There's issues around clean water in a lot of communities, especially through WA and NT. And so off the back of communities losing out, Australia has built this record amount of wealth from mining.
I just wanted to reiterate that 60% of mines in Australia are built next to Aboriginal communities, but yet that they've not reaped, that they're still living below the poverty line. They're not reaping those benefits that they are supposedly supposed to be reaping. Isn't that just that's stark, Larissa, that number?
Yeah, and when I, like, you know, we talk to a lot of communities about mining, and, you know, there was a long time where really we were told that mining will be the solution to income inequality and disadvantage for our communities.
But it's quite,
when you talk to communities now, there's people really can see that we didn't get the benefits that people said when we talk about in terms of contamination, or people just, like, we just didn't get the jobs that people promised us. But also there's been different social issues. Mining hasn't been the savior. And the thing with Juukan Gorge, which I think is really important, is it just really shows the power imbalance that exists between communities and big mining corporations across the country. And I think that, you know, we really desperately need to fix that federal legislation. But that was watered down by the mining lobby as well. So we're kind of trying to get back gains that we already had, because for 30 years the power switch has been switched in their favour. And this is also, I think it goes to, you know, just, we could talk about Juukan Gorge, which is one space, but, you know, we're seeing right across the country. It was out, it came out the other day that, you know, Fortescue, which is Twiggy Forest, holding royalties over traditional owners' heads in order to get clearances and that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's really, we're in a bad place. And I think the amount of criticism that is coming to Rio Tinto is warranted, but really we need to look at the power imbalance across the country. And to me, we're not going to have the type of environmental protections unless we really address that imbalance and we think about the type of power that we have across as First Nations people in this country.
Well, Sis, in the coming weeks, we're doing an in-depth look into gas and coal and renewable energies in Australia, and we'd love to have you be part of that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Deadly. And that was Larissa Baldwin. She's a young woman from the Woodjibal clan of the Bundjalung Nation. And she is the First Nations Justice Campaign Director. I mean, has worked in the space for quite a while. We're going to head to a song by the York Band, another band who will be playing at the at Big Sound 2020. So I'll tell you a little bit more about them after the break. And then we're going to be adding to an amazing young woman because it is Mental Health Week. She's an advocate. She has had lived experience. She also works in the space of mental health and has an incredible insight into what she thinks needs to happen in the space to ensure that First Nations people and people living in the LGBTQI plus community and vulnerable people experience equal opportunity and access to health. So we'll be back very shortly.
Hammer swinging, trying to fix a hole with a whole lot of nonsense to call my life. And I'm fixing it with patches when I'm all covered in patches. Will I be the same? The same old man was raised to be. Will I be? Will I still?
is Bo Spearham and Corina Hogan with Let's Talk.
And that was the York Band with Will I Be. And as I mentioned before the break, the York Band are part of the Big Sound 2020 this year. There's a lineup of, which if you don't know what Big Sound is the culmination of a number of artists brought together to bring them to the forefront. They're emerging and they're up and coming. The York Band obviously are an alternative folk rock band from the York Peninsula, and they met when they were all studying together at the South Australian University. A little bit more about Big Sound this year. If you haven't registered yet, jump onto bigsound.org.au, and it is going to be it's curated, essentially, the Indigenous arm of it anyway, by the deadly Brisbane-based Indigenous artist and producer Alethea Beetson. And so it's a newly created position. It's called the First Nations Producer. And in her new role, Alethea will help to make Big Sound a more culturally appropriate event that celebrates First Nations people and music in a way that is inclusive and authentic. She's a Cubby Cubby and Wiradjuri woman, and she's done extensive work with Indigenous communities. She's done Digi Youth Art. I've personally worked with her. I just think that she's the bee's knees. And in this particular, so it's on the 21st and 22nd of October. So you register for it. It's all gone digital. It's all free. And there's a collection of First Nations artists who will be performing, but also there are also these amazing conversations that are going to take place within within the First Nations sort of part of it, and it's called the conference. It's going viral, and within that conference, you can be a part of conversations around racism, conversations around breaking into the arts industry. There's a conversation also that just sort of looks at what actually is Australian music. You know, like who owns that space and what does it look like? So, yeah, big, big shout out to Alethea and the deadly work that she's doing there in the York Band there with Will I Am. Have a look at their stuff, jump online. But without further ado, as mentioned earlier in the program, it is Queensland Mental Health Week. So I've taken the opportunity this week to delve really deep into the importance of talking about and addressing issues specific to mental health. And Raja Clay is an amazing woman with a solid history working in the mental health space as an advocate and a consumer. She's had lived experience and she currently works in the mental health space. Good morning, Raja.
Good morning. Thank you for having me again.
Thank you for being on. It's such a pleasure having you in. And Raja, before we begin, can you tell us about who your mum is and where you're from?
Yep, I'm a Kalkadoon and Boogaman woman from North Queensland, but I currently live and work in so-called Brisbane.
In so-called Brisbane. Now, tell us, Raja, I want to give the audience a bit of an insight into who you are and how you grew up and a bit about your story. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I have a twin brother. We grew up in foster care. I started to experience symptoms of poor mental health when I was a teenager and went down the help-seeking route and was thankfully able to see a psychologist, and for a period of time they sought out some medication that really helped. And then, yeah, it's just been, I've realised over the years that, like, I guess we always think about, you know, mental health recovery is this concept that is like, once I get to this point, it's like climbing a mountain, get to the pinnacle, you've made it, you've recovered. But I think that's a really potentially like idealistic kind of view of it. I've realized over the years that like mental health is a journey. And then when you add things like for our mob, we know that we are more likely to experience things like intergenerational trauma. So that process of healing things like intergenerational trauma, that's a marathon. That's not like climbing a mountain. That's like, that takes a long time to work through. So yeah, I've been kind of, where I was going with that was that, like, yeah, I've realised over the years that mental health is a journey and it's not a destination.
Yeah, it's not like you get to the top of the hill and you go, yes, I'm never going to cry again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm really open about the fact that I live with anxiety and And depression, it's something I've experienced. Well, you know, and I mentioned it yesterday when we were talking about perinatal and postnatal depression. I recognized it about 2 years ago after my dad passed away, and things really like kind of came to a head. But like in retrospect, like I've had anxiety for a very long time. Like I can pinpoint times when I've had little episodes or whatever you want to call them, and it's just sort of happened and I've just sort of moved on because it's never been something that's been spoken about. And since I've been able to go on the journey of healing and understanding and learning about, you know, what it is that I can do,
yeah,
I can function now.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not something that is so massively detrimental that it's going to completely change my life, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you, Raja, about the label thing, right? Because, you know, we all love a label. I mean, yeah. Gosh.
Society.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Right? Like, yeah. you know, you are an Aboriginal woman, you've lived with mental health, you've also, you're part of the LGBTQI plus community, you know, you tick all these labely boxes or so mm-hmm. on and so forth. For me, like, you can kind of look at those labels in two ways, right?
Yeah.
They're a part of who you are as a person, but then also there's something that people slap on you and have these idealistic or silly ideas of what they actually mean, you know?
Yeah.
How do you feel about labels and how people use them to talk about things like mental health?
Yeah, so you, like, just to clarify, you're talking about things like people like using things like being like making jokes, like being like, oh, I'm OCD, or are you talking more like,
yeah, well, I guess just
you've
the
got
general,
this diagnosis,
the and stigma then, attached yeah, to it. Yeah. Like, yeah, I may be Aboriginal and I may be a woman, but that doesn't mean that I am what you think I am.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For me, it's the most powerful thing about who I am, right? Yeah. But to other people, they look at it and that label means something completely different to them, you know?
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, with you living with mental illness, there's that stigma attached to having mental illness. But really, what's the reality?
Yeah. It's the way we perpetuate that stigma in, like, the everyday kind of interactions that we have, and it's about the language that we use in conversations. And
language is so important, isn't it?
Yeah. And I guess, you know, yeah, language is one of those things that, like, people really pay attention to, and people remember when, you know, for argument's sake, like, when I first got diagnosed with bipolar, I had someone tell me, like, you know, like, essentially that it was a death sentence. And I was like, hold up. Like, what?
Wow.
Like, and the stigma and, like, bias and all those kind of the isms and stuff that this person had about it was just, like, it came from a really uneducated point of view. And, you know, it's not someone that I sat down and had a conversation with and explained bipolar
to. Well,
tell
us this. For you, what is bipolar mean for you?
Yeah, so when I have episodes of experiencing bipolar, there's two different types of bipolar. There's type 1 and type 2. I have type 2, so it its predominant symptoms are, I still get ups and downs, but they are not as necessarily as intense as type 1 bipolar ups and downs could be.
I didn't realize there were two types.
Yeah.
There you go.
So I'm not a doctor. I don't really know the chemistry or anything behind it. But, I also, one thing that I used to get a lot was I would rapid cycle. So I would have periods of having an up, and then I would go into, like, a low, and then I could go back up into another up and just kind of keep going on this cycle of ups and downs. And whilst they weren't extreme, they were still enough to interrupt, like, my daily functioning. So I would notice that I would be talking faster than normally. I would, like, I'd just be everything seemed to be more sped up, and it wasn't like my brain, like my thought process, everything was just, like, running essentially. Going to therapy helped. I was on medication for a while to help kind of set that level.
Yeah.
But, like, going to therapy, I, like, learned kind of that one of the triggers for rapid cycling for me is like lots and lots of stress, like just intense stress. Mm. And so when I was able to figure that out, I was able to work through like periods of feeling stressed and stuff so that I wouldn't then kind of build up to this point of experiencing rapid cycling. But it was a process, and it's like that's just my personal experience. It's not the same for anyone else who experiences bipolar type 2.
And I think that's important as well to recognize as well, Raja, especially given the space that you work in and the amount of different people that you've worked in, is that there is not a one-fix-all approach.
No, absolutely not. And I guess that's the thing in healthcare is like we like to provide adequate and like appropriate healthcare, especially to our mob, it has to be tailored and it has to have other considerations and things like that in it. And those considerations, you know, they may not necessarily happen in a fast-paced environment like an emergency department. Sometimes those things, like they're not necessarily a priority to an emergency physician. So, or an on-call reg, because, you know, they've got 30 or 40 other people to see or something. So, like, they, yeah. But, like, the importance of it is that, like, all those things, because, you know, cultural competency and safety in healthcare is, like, it is a big reason why mob don't seek help. And when it's done good, it, like, it's extremely beneficial to that community, and it fosters a stronger relationship with that community.
Which I suppose is a little bit difficult because during the break, like you and I were sort of always also mentioning, like, because we spoke before to a historian for Let's Talk History. We spoke to Tony Birch about Christopher Columbus Day and, you know, the furfies that exist around that. But then we also spoke to Larissa about climate change and the environment, which you may think is just completely a different topic to mental health. But as we were saying during the break, is that it's all intertwined. Yeah. Like, you know, that these glorifications of people throughout white history that are just simply not true perpetuates a belief that then reaches out to certain people who may come in contact with an Indigenous person and have these biases that sort of sit below and bubble below, you know, like that are just kind of there. What does cultural competency look like for you, like in a hospital setting?
If we were to talk like specifically about that, it's it would be
it's not just like one solution
could fix it. It's not like, you know, oh, we'll figure out a ratio for like Indigenous staff to clients or consumers. Like that's quite tokenistic. Mm. It's about like ensuring that everyone who is in a service delivery position in that space has the understanding of Australia's history, and maybe it's contextualized to the local area so they're able to understand the local communities, relationships with
relationships is a big one. Hey,
with like, because I guess that's it. Like the government and hospitals do fall under a public service. Our mob haven't always had good relationships with the government. It's always been quite a protector, quite a paternalistic approach and response. And in that,
it's almost like you got to redefine the relationship.
Yeah,
hey?
Exactly.
And it's multi-layered. Like I'm asking you that question, but that's actually my job. Like I work on a hospital board myself, and cultural competency is something that we're talking about in depth, and it's massive when it comes to our strategic direction, and it's very central to what I think is important within the hospital system. You know, we did cultural training only last week with three deadly blackfellas from the hospital who delivered the training. But it's a long process, isn't it?
Yeah. You know? I think part of it's also being trauma-informed. Mm. And that's not just like...
What does that mean to you?
So for me, to be trauma-informed is to like understand that this is wholly my own personal perception of what it means to be trauma-informed, is to understand that where people are at, if they're presenting with like mental health or they're in contact with criminal justice or they have substance use issues or something, being trauma-informed is understanding that there has been things that have happened in that person's life that have resulted in it's been a traumatic event for this person, and they've either been able to access and have the opportunities to access support and help and work through that, or they haven't. And so,
and
because it's quite easy to criminalize those people too. That's
isn't that what's happening at the moment?
You look at trauma and then there's poverty and things like that. And it's like that whole cycle in itself is like we're putting, for argument's sake, we're putting young people in juvies because they're stealing food or they're jumping the train or to get home or different things like that. But if we take a bigger, if we take a step back and look at the bigger picture, we can, and we're trauma informed and we have trauma, like the trauma lens on, we can see that there's like maybe potentially homes of traumatic experience, maybe schools traumatic, and then you can kind of, that's where you can start to figure out where to go and how to support this person.
And if you've just joined us here at 98.9 FM's Let's Talk program, I'm chatting with Raja Clay, who is a Kalgoorlie Balkaman woman with a solid history working in the mental health space as an advocate, a consumer, and someone with lived experience. She has an amazing story. And if you or anyone you know are experiencing mental health issues, you can call Lifeline on 131114. There's also Headspace, 1-800-650-890. Kids Helpline, 1-800-551-800. But I can also not encourage you enough to visit your local Aboriginal medical service.
Absolutely.
How important do you think it is that blackfellas are involved in working and delivering health services?
I think it's imperative because when we, like, in the mental health space, we have a thing called the peer workforce. And that, I feel like when people have a lived experience or they're working with their mob, that allows a different kind of, I guess, understanding and empathy to how you go about your practice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes a difference of someone who has a good appointment and someone who doesn't have a good appointment with a health professional.
Yeah, and so now I want to get back to talking about you, Raja. You've had a very up and down or a very long history of living with mental illness and understanding it. Where are you at with it now?
Yeah, so I still see a psychologist and all those different things like those, things that I've talked to my GP about. We've come up with a plan to kind of manage my mental health, but I have really enjoyed getting out into nature and going on bushwalks. It's one of my favourite things. And it's hard being
in
Brisbane.
I can't wait to go on a bushwalk with
you. Yeah, it'll be incredible.
I do that as well, sis.
Yeah.
Exercise for me is imperative to my mental health.
Yeah, and I use it as an opportunity to connect with country because being in Brisbane and away from home, it can feel quite isolating at times. And so when I'm out on a bushwalk, I like to acknowledge, like pay my respects, acknowledge that I'm on, you know, these mobs' country, thank them for it, you know, and just like do a whole like mindful process of connecting with whatever country I'm on. Being creative has been really helpful. Just like it's been really nice after a long day of work, just like putting on a playlist and doing some painting.
Yeah. What are the triggers for you, sis? So what do you look out for as far as like, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm starting to waver? Does it sort of just pop up suddenly or?
No, you can usually tell. So like there's like little things that you know, people might do so that they might be starting to isolate themselves from their social group. They may not be talking to their friends as much or, you know, they may just start to disappear from the social group. People's eating habits change. They might start to, you know, look like they're putting on weight or losing weight. They may look like they're not sleeping very well. Yeah, I guess for me personally, like I know when it's hard to get out of bed in the mornings when I just lie in bed for an extra, you know, 10 or 15 minutes and not because I'm sleeping, just because I'm can't get out of bed. Things like that. You notice like little things that start to impact on how you go about your day. And I guess that's when you kind of know when your mental health or your well-being is starting to decline or, you know, start to feel a bit poor is when, I guess, those symptoms of, like, anxiety or depression, yeah. like the feeling low,
yeah.
the, like, can't leave the house or, you know, panicking about talking to people. It's like when those feelings and symptoms start to impact your daily life, that's kind of, I think that's a good time, it's a good way to know when, that you need to talk to someone mm. when, you know, life's getting a bit difficult to do because of, you know, yeah, you're feeling yeah. really sad some days and it's hard to get out of bed or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sis, if there's someone listening now, a young person out there who is really struggling with their mental health and feels like there's no way out, I know that you've had moments where you've, and you shared with us last time that you've been really at your rock bottom, really low, and felt as though there was no way out, right? But you're sitting here in front of me, bright, wonderful, doing amazing things. I admire you. I think you're amazing.
Thank you.
What would you say to those people or that person that's listening right now or that the parent of a person who's listening who knows that their child is just not right, there's something yeah. going on. It may be substance abuse. It may be that yeah. there was abuse as a young person. It may be a mental health condition. What would you say to a mum or a dad or even a person experiencing it right now?
Yeah, I would – sounds really really all like nice and stuff. It's like, honestly, just like keep going, you know, like go to sleep. Tomorrow's a new day. Mm. It's like, I'm not saying that's going to necessarily be a better day than today, but it's like, at least if you go to sleep, tomorrow's another day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, yeah, I guess it's really easy to get caught in that thing of just being like, there is so much to work on. There's so much going on. I don't know where to start. I don't, like, it can be really hard. But it's like just, you know, talking to a friend, maybe telling them that, you know, I'm going through a rough time at the moment,
mm.
reaching out to someone. There's, you can call Lifeline. There's other services that people can call and access. Yeah, I guess at the end of the day is just like, yeah, I don't know. It was a long process. It was a very long process to get to the point of where I'm at today and get to the point where, and honestly, it was, I had a moment where I realized that my life was worth more than whatever situations were going on, whatever relationships I had at the time, like all this kind of stuff. Like, that was important to me, but, like, at the end of the day, like, my life is really important to me
mm.
and my future is important to me. And so, you know, yeah, it's – I'm so glad that I did stick around, like, you know, because it would have
– Me too.
Yeah. It's not like it wasn't something that didn't go through my head. Like, mm. it's something I've talked about before, but it's like I – at the end of the day, I'm glad that I'm sitting here across from you having mm. a conversation, and I'm glad that, you know, at the end of the day, I went to sleep and I woke up the next day
mm.
and I just kept doing that. Mm. And, you know, sometimes – and talk about – it's like you're in that stage of surviving and I guess, you know
– Or not wanting to survive.
Yeah, or like you're surviving. You're just getting through every day as mm. it comes, and then eventually at some point you find yourself – through, you know, working with, you know, people that'll support your social and emotional well-being and build you up and all that kind of stuff, you find yourself in a place where you're now thriving and you're mm. not surviving.
Mm.
And I think that's a really beautiful kind of space. And that's, you know, I'm definitely feeling like I'm in the space of where I'm thriving
mm.
and not necessarily just surviving every single day.
So big takeaway messages, seek help.
Yeah.
Speak about it.
Yeah.
Know that you'll get through it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And know that it's not always going to be perfect. Like, there's never a moment where you sort of get to a point where you're just like, yep, I'm done. I'm happy. Never going to cry again.
Yeah.
You know, I know I've had deep, dark moments of sadness yeah. as well. And coming out of that, it's so corny, yeah. but it makes you a stronger person.
It does.
Really, really does.
Yeah.
So just once again, I just want to encourage you, if you are listening and this has brought up anything for you, you know, call Lifeline 131114, call Headspace 1-800-650-890. And Raja, I understand that since COVID's kind of kicked off, they've been doing these online counselling sessions.
Yeah. So
in fact, a friend of mine did one
yeah.
and sent me the transcript.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, he sent me the transcript just to show me sort of what they were talking about because he hadn't sought help yet or before ever. Yeah. So this was a good opportunity for him to then have this conversation without having to sort of speak because of his anxiety. And
that's brilliant.
And it is brilliant. And funnily enough, today is it's following a face-to-face meeting with someone.
Oh, brilliant.
So it may be that it doesn't lead to anything.
Yeah.
But it could just be that one conversation plants that little seed.
Absolutely.
And sis, suicide's massive in our community.
Yeah.
I don't want to see it anymore.
No. The other thing I will mention is the federal government in their last budget that they've just announced has just announced that they are moving the under the mental health care plans, which you can go to your GP and access, and they're moving it from 10 sessions up to 20. So that'll be brilliant.
Brilliant.
If you can hop along, if you find you are struggling with your social and emotional well-being, if you pop along to your local Aboriginal health service or your GP, have a chat about a mental health care plan and, you know, get on the journey of having a yarn to someone about what's going on.
And also, it may not be the first person that you speak to, the first counsellor you speak to, but it might be the second, third, fourth, fifth person.
Exactly.
But once you find that person, like I found, it took a long time. Like
persistence is key, honestly, because that's the thing with, I think something so specific about mental health is like you have to find someone that you connect with and that you feel comfortable and safe sharing quite distressing or upsetting things about yourself with someone. And so I've seen so many different psychologists and I literally just, it was hard at times. Sometimes I wanted to give up because I had such a bad experience with some of them. But at the end of the day, I was like, no, I've got to do this for myself. So I kept just going and going and going until I found someone. And, you know, word of mouth was the best way that I found someone. But persistence is key, to this thing. Yeah.
Well, sis, it's been amazing having you on the program again.
Thank you.
I always love having you on. I think that you're amazing. At only 22 years of age, you are kicking goals like beyond many young people. And we know that we have such a young population among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So, you know that if you're out there and you're listening and you are struggling with your mental health, you're not the only one.
Yeah.
No shame. Yeah, no shame. Take the shame out of it and, you know, get out there. Sis, I'm going to take us out with a song from a Souls Blue musician who's part of this Big Sound 2020 that I've been talking about. And I hope to God that I pronounce her name right. But Yajilia, I believe her name is Yajilia, and she's an amazing artist from Cairns. And she says that she wants to push the boundaries of being an Aboriginal contemporary artist and create diversity and inclusion in the music industry. Yajilia hopes to give back to the community, provide opportunities for Indigenous youth and positively influence those around her. So that's why I particularly chose this song and this person because I feel like that's what you do, sis.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and I want to continue to see you push those boundaries and advocate for MOB and yeah, I look forward to having you on our program again soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
You too. And if you've enjoyed the program, you can listen to the repeat tonight at 7 p.m. on 98.9 FM or you can download our podcast, which will be up later on in the day at 98.9 FM. Stay safe and I look forward to having a yarn with you again tomorrow live from the kiosk down at Boundary Street. So make sure you tune in or head down to Boundary Street in Brisbane and come and say hi.